Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The trials of former Spanish judge Baltasar Garzon were arbitrary and did not comply with the principles of judicial independence and impartiality, the UN Human Rights Committee concluded on Thursday. The committee emphasized that even if Mr. Garzon had committed a judicial error in the two major political cases of Franco and Gürtel, they should have been corrected by a review before a higher court and not through the criminal prosecution. In the Franco case, Mr. Garzon assumed jurisdiction to investigate and forced disappearances during the Civil War and the dictatorship of General Francisco Franco. In the Gürtel case, the former judge decided to monitor communications between defendants and their representatives to prevent the commission of crimes. The former judge of the Spanish National Court was criminally prosecuted and tried in 2012 for alleged willful abuse of power. He was acquitted in the Franco case, but was convicted in the Gürtel case and disbarred from office for 11 years. The next 3 months will be a critical period for stepping up global collective action against future pandemics, according to the head of the World Health Organization. Although the COVID-19 caseload stabilized last week after nearly 2 months of increases, the level remains high, said WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, adding that as long as the virus is circulating anywhere, it's a threat everywhere. He noted that three major meetings, the UN General Assembly in September, followed by the G20 summit in October, and a special session of the World Health Organization's governing body set for November, would be critical for shaping the future of pandemic preparedness and response. A report issued by a G20-established high-level independent panel calls for strengthening WHO and repurposing the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other multilateral development banks so that they can help countries deliver a speedy response whenever a pandemic emerges. The panel has also proposed the creation of a global health threat fund to mobilize $10 billion annually and the establishment of a new governance mechanism that brings together financial and health decision makers. The decision by Malawi's Supreme Court of Appeal to resume imposing the death penalty raises serious concerns on the due administration of justice, UN Human Rights spokesperson Marta Hurtado said on Thursday. The move comes 4 months after a judgment that was widely understood to abolish the death penalty in the country. Ms. Hurtado argued that the death penalty is inconsistent with a state's duty to protect the fundamental right to life, and there's no evidence globally that it has a deterrent effect on serious crimes. The risk that an innocent person may be condemned to death is heightened in Malawi, she added, as the law does not criminalise confessions extracted under duress, including through torture and ill treatment, nor preclude their admission as evidence in court. Ms. Hurtado warned that the renewed uncertainty for people who have been sentenced to death could lead to intense suffering for both themselves and their families. She also reminded the government and parliament of Malawi that they can still take steps to formally abolish the death penalty in the country through legislation. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and today is Women's Equality Day, August 26th, and it's the 101st anniversary of the adoption of the 19th Amendment, and something to celebrate, but it took a while for all women in the United States to really be able to vote, even after that was enacted in 1920. We've learned a lot about that voter suppression. Now voting rights are endangered for everybody, especially the young and minorities in this country. So let's get that John Lewis Act passed. 2 days ago, the U.S. House passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Now it's up to the Senate, and very, very important for everybody to be able to exercise that most civil of all rights.
And I vote for that, too. I'm Dan Barker, co-host of Free Thought Radio. This is our August 26th, 2021 edition of the show. Grant Blaschka of Audio for the Arts is engineering in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio in the national offices of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
Free Thought Radio is, as always, the weekly production of FFRF. The Freedom From Religion Foundation works to keep religion out of government, keep it at bay, and also is the largest association of like-minded freethinkers, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, humanists, with over 35,000 members. If you are a member, terrific. Thank you. If you're not, we would be glad to send you information, including a complimentary copy of our lively newspaper, Free Thought Today, a brochure about our 40-plus years of achievements, and ask you to support this vital need to buttress the wall of separation between church and state at ffrf.org.
During the second half of today's show, we're going to talk about the influence and the perils of evangelicalism around the world, especially in Brazil. What role did the religious right play to bring to power the U.S. President Trump and Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro? FFRF's Director of Communications, Amit Paul, is going to join us as we interview Benjamin Cohen about his book, Moral Majorities Across the Americas, Brazil, the U.S., and the Creation of the Religious Right.
And Benjamin Cohen, I guess we're going to have to find out how he pronounces it. It's C-O-W-A-N. Benjamin Cohen is Professor of History at the University of California, San Diego. We're going to ask how Brazil, a historically Catholic country, has come under the sway of evangelical Christians. We're also going to introduce you to some impressive first-in-their-family-to-go-to-college student winners of FFRF's Forward Prethought Tuition Relief Fund. That will be coming up in the second segment. And these students, very impressive students, are chosen in partnership with Black Skeptics Los Angeles.
This Sunday is the anniversary of the birth of Charlie Parker, the jazz saxophonist and composer. He was born August 29, 1920. Known for his improvisation, he was nicknamed Bird or Yardbird. Charlie Parker's common-law wife, Chan Berg, with whom they had two children, said he was a lifelong confirmed atheist. We're going to hear some of Charlie Parker's music today during the breaks, including Confirmation, I Remember You, Now's the Time, and The Song Is You.
Yesterday on our live Facebook TV show, Ask an Atheist, I was joined by FFRF's Director of Governmental Affairs, Mark Dan, and we talked with Christina DeLeon. She's an atheist who has been elected to her local town council in Black Diamond, Washington, and she discussed her bizarre experience running against and then dealing with staunch white supremacists and Christian nationalists.
Christina DeLeon spoke about the need for secular people to run for government and how she spoke out against religious bullies on her local city council and school board.
Again, more of us need to speak out, interrupt the kind of, you know, even like the jokes and the racist imagery or language that we hear, because otherwise this is what goes unfettered. And while we're over here too worried about really speaking up and also being proud of who we are, you know, this is the group that's going to have the monopoly. And then we will end up playing into their narrative that we are somebody to be ashamed of, you know, and that includes secular atheists. Like, there is nothing wrong. In fact, the quite the opposite of being an atheist, of being a humanist and serving in public office. So it's about also getting people back to issues that care about. At the end of the day, these folks are bullies in the kindest sense of what I could be describing them as. And it's fascism, too. They're fascist bullies, right? And at the end of the day, they don't have policy ideas. They have fear-mongering. There's all this misinformation about vaccines and, quote-unquote, critical race theory, but no actual policies about getting better things done for our students in the school board or about our roads or about holding large companies accountable in our cities and about better zoning and better environmental protection. So because there's that sort of like absence of policy and really making a difference, we gravitate towards these kinds of things since, you know, they do this instead. And we have to keep pushing back that there is a better way forward.
You can always catch that entire show, FFRF's Ask an Atheist, at FFRF's YouTube channel. You can also ask for the Ask an Atheist playlist on our YouTube channel to see them all. And next week...
I don't know what the topic is. I think Patrick's working on something. But you can tune in next week and ask a question of your own. FFRF's Ask an Atheist usually airs at 12 noon Central on FFRF's Facebook page.
So there's a lot of news that we're going to go through briefly, but of course we need to celebrate the fact that the FDA formally approved the Pfizer vaccine on Monday, and we have seen it looks like it will be a game changer, and the secular community needs to raise our voices even louder, get those emails and letters and phone calls to public officials demanding that there should be mandatory vaccination required of teachers to go to public schools, of any public employees. We are seeing a lot of corporations doing the right thing now. But I did a blog this week about the continuing harm of religion in this, the anti-science deniers, in spreading the pandemic by their policies. Many governors, many states, about seven states making it illegal to even mandate a vaccine mandate. So we're really dealing with a lot of ignorance. There was also a blog by Barbara Alvarez about the irony in Texas where they're talking about taking away women's right to abortion on September 1st, a draconian law going into effect. And then they're saying that it's a violation of people's bodily integrity to mandate a vaccination. So high irony. So we're still watching all of that greatly. We want to invite you to a major gathering, a free thought gathering of women of color, Women of Color Beyond Belief. The 2021 conference is going to take place at the Marriott Chicago Midway the weekend of September 24th and 26th. And you have to get your room reservations in at the hotel by tomorrow. It's the only national secular forum exclusively focused on the perspectives of women of color, atheists, agnostics, and so on. It will also be something that you can watch virtually. If you're not able to travel, there are going to be a lot of speakers, including Candace Gorham, whom we've had on Free Thought Radio, Cheryl Abram, a whole roster. And the Freedom from Religion Foundation is pleased once again to be the quote-unquote legendary sponsor, the largest sponsor of this event with $10,000, and we'll be there. Dan and I will be there. Barbara Alvarez will be there. So we hope you'll be there. In the national news, we are looking, of course, at this wretched situation in Afghanistan, and we want you to know that the Freedom from Religion Foundation has called on the Biden administration to ensure that refugees from Afghanistan, including the non-religious, are given quick and safe passage. In terms of other national news, we have pointed out the urgent need for court reform that is shown in a recent chain of judicial decisions. A couple of nights ago, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative bloc upheld an order from a Trump-appointed judge that reinstated the harsh Trump immigration policy. And this was a 44-year-old Trump appointment that we had opposed, a decision by Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, and he is a Christian nationalist, shouldn't have been appointed. And we see the Supreme Court now rubber-stamping this federal district judge's decision dictating policy from the bench. We really need court reform. And on one other front, as we all saw the news about the bombing plot at the Capitol again in the last week that was thwarted, but Andrew Seidel, who is our director of strategic response, was watching it in live time as it was unfolding and did a lot of research, and we got out a press release immediately, thanks to Andrew, pointing out the Christian nationalist roots of this terrorist. This has not been widely reported, and this man who drove his black pickup truck from North Carolina and parked it in front of the Library of Congress with the makings of a homemade bomb had live-streamed rants leading off to this standoff, proclaiming that he was picked by the American people. I love this land. I love God. He was clearly buying the Kool-Aid that Trump won the election. He was going off on Biden. He thought that he was going to, when he came home, Trump would be elected. He thought his actions were going to do that, his revolution. And so once again, we see the danger of our homegrown Christian nationalist terrorists. He's right out of the January 6th mold. And there's some important research that you can find on our press release, thanks to Andrew's looking at the everything he had up on his social media posts. Very obviously a Christian nationalist. So
and the danger of irrational thinking that many religious people have. Other news that you can find on our news release page at FFRF.org, dealing with our own FFRF complaints. FFRF is rebuking the Mississippi Agriculture and Commerce Commissioner, Andy Gibson. He's a Baptist minister. He posted a video to his official Facebook page on August 18th, identified by his official title, and it looks like he's sitting in his government office reading the Bible and calling on people to pray for God to end the pandemic.
Would you join me in praying for America that God would calm this storm? And until that day comes, keep trusting in God to get us through this and to teach us that we need to depend more on Him and less on ourselves, because ultimately, God is in control.
So one of the things that we noted this week was the supposed recovery of this cardinal who had told people that the pandemic would plant a microchip in you, anti-vaxxer, Cardinal Burke, anti-abortionist extremist, who said that the only thing you could rely on in the pandemic is Jesus Christ. Apparently, Jesus wasn't looking when this guy got put on the ventilator, and then they had the nerve to issue a press release when he was taken off the ventilator, giving the credit to God.
And we have asked that Mississippi agriculture guy, Gibson, to delete that video and stop this unconstitutional exclusionary practice. Besides, as Annie Laurie pointed out, it's irrational. God could have stopped the COVID in the first place. In Tennessee, we're asking Governor Bill Lee to stop posting sectarian religious messages on his social media pages. One of his official tweets, among many, quotes Psalm 90, "Let the favor of our Lord God be upon us and establish the work of our hands." Yes, establish the work of our hands. It's unconstitutional for an elected secular official to abuse his office by promoting his personal religious beliefs and excluding all those who don't follow his religion. Over in Virginia, we're asking the Buchanan County School Board to stop misusing a so-called moment of silence to recite Christian prayers. This excludes non-religious or non-Christian students and parents. And we want to call your attention to a letter by FFRF staff attorney Ryan Jane that ran last weekend in the Springfield News Leader, one of Missouri's most prominent newspapers, warning about the drawbacks of a new statewide school voucher program. Starting next year, Jane writes, state tax money will begin to pay for tuition at private religious schools, mostly for students who would have gone to those schools anyway. He concludes, Missouri lawmakers have taken funds away from children and given it to churches. Legislators should scrap the program before it does serious damage. You could look for his letter in the Springfield News Leader.
Coming up, we are going to hear the stories of the impressive winners of the Forward Free Thought Tuition Relief Fund for free-thinking students of color who are first in their family to attend college.
And then after that, we're going to talk about right-wing evangelicals in Brazil. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is very happy to be partnering with Black Skeptics Los Angeles to provide tuition relief scholarships to deserving students of color, mainly of color, who are first in their family to go to college. This year's third annual distribution of the Forward Freethought Tuition Relief Scholarships are funded by very generous FFRF member Lance Bredvold, single-handedly. The winners were selected by Black Skeptics Los Angeles, an African-American humanist-atheist community-based organization.
Black Skeptics Los Angeles founder Sikivu Hutchinson says, "Secular African-American youth disproportionately come from religious backgrounds and communities. These youth are often marginalized in K-12 and higher education due to their nonconformity. This scholarship program provides a platform for their voices and experiences." And so there were five winners this year, mm-hmm. Is that right? One of them is named Harini Putheri, who's going to Cal Poly Pomona. Belen Padilla. So these are African Americans and Hispanic. Kaylin Nelson. Belen's going to Scripps College. Kaylin Nelson is going to the University of Central Florida. Stephanie Avitia, UC Berkeley. And Natasha Herrera is going to UC Irvine.
So three of the recipients got $5,000, and then two of them split the $5,000, so they got $2,500 to make this go a little further. And each of these students made an acceptance video, and let's listen to some of them.
Hello, my name is Harini Putheri, and I will be going to Cal Poly Pomona. Actually, I'm moving in today as a foster youth of color. I am especially at risk for factors that prevent foster youth from going to college. This scholarship has given me the security that I know that I will graduate, which only 3% of foster youth are able to do. And I'm really grateful that the scholarship is also secular and not religion-based, because I know there are a lot of organizations who have this kind of religious undertone that they want to help, but they're doing it in God's name. Or I have had some experiences with foster families who have wanted me to convert to their religion. And as a humanist, I don't want to be subscribed to a religious belief in order to believe that everyone has their own potential. I'm just really grateful that I've been given this opportunity.
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I'll be attending UC Berkeley in the fall with a major in bioengineering and a minor in climate science. This award is important to me as a Latina atheist because it shows that I am not alone. Coming from a community and culture that shoves religion down your throat from the moment you are born, you can't help but feel like an outsider when you start to question things. This award not only showed me that I am not alone, but it can also help me motivate and encourage other youth who may be questioning their religion to do their own research, reach out, and not be afraid to communicate and say, this doesn't make sense to me, or you know what, this is not necessarily what I believe in. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kaylin Nelson, and I am one of the winners of the First in the Family Humanist Scholarship. In the next few weeks, I will be attending the University of Central Florida, where I will be majoring in social work. As someone who is raised in a religious family but does not necessarily subscribe to the same beliefs as my family, making me a secular youth, I understand how important mental health services can be for people like me. Often, our families do not understand this divergence in thoughts or beliefs. We are seen as rebels or deviants simply for not believing. I know that this can be extremely alienating. Personally, when I have struggled with mental health issues in the past or been caught in difficult situations, the only answer that I have ever been given was prayer. At times like those, I would have benefited greatly from having someone who was unbiased or non-religious to listen to me and to provide me with guidance. With the help of this scholarship, I will be able to pursue my dreams of becoming a counselor and opening my own practice in a low-income area. As someone of intersecting marginalized identities, I acknowledge that it's significantly harder to get ahead in today's society. I understand that higher education is a privilege that not everyone is afforded, and I'm deeply grateful to have made it this far.
Hello, my name is Natasha Herrera, and in the fall I will be attending the University of California, Irvine as a biological sciences major, and I think it's very important the message that the Black Skeptics Los Angeles sends with trying to get past religion and separate from that when people are the ones who can really make the change. As a white passing mixed person myself, I know that I have privileges that people in my family who look darker, who look more like my Black and Filipino side, they don't have the same privileges as me. I've always been very interested in civil rights and voting, and I think programs like this that support getting people educated is very important. I hope to go into the medical field and help to combat racial inequities in the healthcare field, and I am very thankful that the Black Skeptics Los Angeles has enabled me to do that. Thank you.
So those are four of the five winners, all very impressive, and they'll also their essays will be featured in the upcoming issue of Free Thought Today. And FFRF is very proud that we give over $100,000 a year in scholarships. Many of those go to winners of our six essay competitions. We have Student Activist Awards, and now we are working with Black Skeptics in the First in the Family Awards are for Free Thought Tuition Relief. Very, very important given the high cost of education and given the fact that there are so many programs out there that reward orthodoxy in non-thinking by students, so we need to counter that. So
those were just excerpts of their videos.
Yes.
Are we going to be able to see those videos online?
Yes, I think so. And you can also donate to the scholarships at FFRF.org if you want to continue to help students.
Well,
succeed.
I thought those videos were very, very moving and encouraging. So we're going to take a break. And Annie Laurie, you'll be stepping out. Is that right?
I'll be signing off to lead this interview to you and to FFRF's Director of Communications, Amit Paul, because you've both read the book, and I haven't. And so I'll be leaving. I'll be back next week.
So Amit Paul is going to join me after the break as we speak with professor and author Benjamin Cohen, we'll have to ask him how he pronounces it, about the connection between the religious right in America and Brazil. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
Imagine there's no countries. It is the hardest to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only.
Hope someday you join us, and the world will be as one. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker, and that was the Brazilian singer Sandra Belé. She's a friend of mine. She was singing John Lennon's Imagine. When I was in Brazil a few years ago, I met a number of freethinkers, atheists, agnostics, and humanists like Sandra, and like the guitarist Romero Zeferino. They are really concerned about the rise of the religious right in Brazil, in their country. Joining me today to talk about this is FFRF's Director of Communications, Amit Pal, who's from another country currently suffering from religious nationalism, who will introduce our guest today. Good to have you here. Thanks for joining today, Amit.
Thank you, Dan. Yes, as I say, it's a global phenomenon, right-wing populism in India, the United States, both my countries, and in Brazil with the advent to power of Jair Bolsonaro. And to shed light on that and to give background, we have with us Professor Benjamin Cowan. He's the Associate Professor of History at the University of California, San Diego. His interest in right-wing radicalism, morality, sexuality, and 20th century imperialism has led him to focus on Cold War Brazil, with a specialization in the cultural and gender history of the 1964 to 1985 era of Brazilian military rule, a pivotal period in Brazilian history. I teach a course on the politics of Latin America at Edgewood College here in Madison. And coincidentally, I showed a documentary on Pelé, which focused in good part on his silence.
The soccer superstar.
Yeah. And it focused on his silence about the repression happening during this period, in part. Dr. Cowan's first book, Securing Sex, Morality and Repression in the Making of Cold War Brazil, was published in 2016. That book won three awards, including the prestigious Brazil Section Book Award from the Latin American Studies Association. This year, he has published a second monograph, Moral Majorities Across the Americas, Brazil, the United States, and the Creation of the Religious Right, also from the University of North Carolina Press, coincidentally, my alma mater. And that's the book we'll be discussing today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your book provides us a broad and deep history that gives us a backdrop of how we have gotten, both in Brazil and the United States, to where we are today. Could you tell our listeners, what role did the religious right play in Brazil and the United States in bringing to power both Jair Bolsonaro and Donald Trump?
Well, thank you for the question. It's an excellent one, and really one that puzzled me, and is sort of why I wrote this book. I think the most important thing is trying to understand how religious conservatism managed to unite a set of cultural precepts, what we might think of as culture wars, with sort of free market extremism, right? What some people like to call neoliberalism, right? Or the notion that, you know, government intervention is socialism, right? And is the enemy. I mean, on paper, there's a lot of problems sort of linking those two things, right? And many progressive Christians have pointed to the ways in which, you know, opposing social welfare programs can be considered un-Christian. So that was sort of my big question, right? And the answer to that, I think, is that the religious right in Brazil, in the United States, and elsewhere managed to promote a sort of identity, right, in which policies, actual policies, sort of fall into the background, right, as an identity, a religious identity that is politicized, comes to the fore. And thus, you know, we get to the place where we are in both Brazil and the United States, where we have sort of elite thinkers puzzling over how people can vote, quote, against their own interests economically. And the answer to that, right, is that a certain elite in the religious right managed to successfully package religious conservatism and what we now think of as economic conservatism as a set of political identities. And that happens across denominations and across national borders, and is why eventually we get to the sort of conundrums of a Jair Bolsonaro and a Donald Trump, right? All the head scratching that many people do when it comes to the contradictions inherent in some of these right-wing populist figures are explained by decades of work by religious right-wing activists who really sought to unite these social, cultural, and economic conservatisms.
And one of the factors you write in your book that seems to unite all of these countries in this right-wing movement is this, what you call an anti-democratic yearning for vague, mythic past, you know, make America great again, or make India great again, right? Like Modi's doing.
Right.
So that's happening in Brazil too, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the MAGA, right, the sort of the slogans are sort of easy examples of this. And the one that comes to mind for me is, I want my country back. That's something that we hear in the United States. It's also something that is, you know, sort of touted by conservatives in Brazil. And there's a way that we can think of this as kind of a parroting, right? And what I try to show in the book is that actually these are sort of senses of self that emerge simultaneously and through a series of complex processes of coincidence, but also cooperation. So definitely this is something that is happening in Brazil, right? Jair Bolsonaro, for all the contradictions and sort of incompetencies inherent in his regime, appeals to a certain sort of anti-logical and even anti-rational notion of wanting my country back. In Brazil, it's "Eu quero meu país de volta," right? I would like my country back. And that isn't a reference necessarily to a specific time or place so much as it is to an imagined space of belonging that depends on traditional values that are often bound up with religiosity.
So, você também fala português, looks like. So, so it seems like a contradiction to me, yearning for the past, but isn't Brazil have a history of Catholicism, really? And so how can embracing this modern right-wing evangelicalism we see, how does that go back to their yearning for a mythic past?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent question, right? And it's one that I have scratched my own head over many times in doing this research, right? And I think actually for me, one of the answers is that the sort of the notion of this as a Christian identity actually manages to sort of paper over that contradiction, right? There were several times in the research when I encountered, you know, evangelicals in Brazil and the United States kind of yearning for a pre-Reformation past, right? So sort of touting a kind of medievalism that we would associate maybe with conservative Catholics more than with conservative Protestants. And I think that the way that that is possible is by thinking of that past as kind of supra-denominational, right? So thinking of the past in which, you know, certain kinds of Christian hierarchies determined how life should be lived as something that is fundamental to all Christians and that all Christians can agree upon before they would make any alliance with anyone who might sort of threaten any of those values. And I think maybe one thing that sort of, you know, packages that into a digestible nutshell is a quote from a Catholic lawmaker in Brazil, whom I cite in the introduction to the book, talking about this sort of, you know, mixed up and maybe confusing alliance with conservative evangelicals, right? You would think Catholics, evangelicals, they have a lot to disagree about. But he says something like, well, it's better to have an evangelical church around the corner than it is to have a strip club, right? And you can see in that how there's a building of a Christian identity around the notion of culture wars that can supersede any of these kind of denominational differences in a really ahistorical way, right? So that a mythic past of theocratic hierarchy becomes something that all Christians can sort of consider in common.
One of the things that your book does amazingly well is to unearth these transnational connections between the U.S. and the Brazilian religious right, especially in the 1980s. Names that many of our listeners will recall, such as Paul Weyrich, Jimmy Swaggart, Billy Graham. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that surprised me over and over again in the research was the ways in which people are crossing borders and thinking transnationally. And, you know, when I say transnationally, I mean they are thinking of themselves less as subjects of a particular nation, than as members of a community that transcends nations, right? And so you have someone like Billy Graham saying things like, well, the United States is kind of already lost, saying that he's embarrassed about the moral turpitude of the United States, and that that is why he is going to Brazil, right? Thinking of Christians in Brazil as kind of a new constituency that can help him to save something like the West or something like, you know, Christian culture from a threat that isn't about the United States and isn't about Brazil, right, is a supranational threat, right? Very often we think of religious conservatism, because Christian nationalism is so vocal, we think of the nationalism as the most important part of this. And while it is important, it turns out it doesn't preclude people from making connections across national lines when it comes to Christian conservatism. And so you get Brazilian evangelicals who are admiring and consuming and in dialogue with conservative Christians from the United States, and also vice versa. And part of what I try to show in the book is how, you know, many of these Christian conservatisms, especially those in these sort of key positions of constructing a religious right platform, are thinking of themselves as people who cross not only denominational, but also national borders.
Well, we have to talk about that after the break. We're continuing our conversation with Benjamin Cowan, a professor at University of California, San Diego, about his new book, Moral Majorities Across the Americas, Brazil, the U.S., and the Creation of the Religious Right. And we'll be back after the break to talk more with Benjamin Cowan. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom from Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, no gods, no masters. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio, and I'm Dan Barker, and we're continuing our conversation with Professor Benjamin Cowan, author of the book Majorities Across the Americas, Brazil, the United States, and the Creation of the Religious Right. And I'm joined in studio with FFRS Director of Communications, Amit Paul, who knows a lot about dictatorships and about Latin America.
Yes, Dan. You know, I'm in fact teaching a course on Latin America at Edward College here in Madison. And specialization of the academic specialization of Dr. Cowan is the Brazilian dictatorship from 1964 to 1985 or so, more than 20 years, spanned the gamut from the Lyndon Johnson administration all the way to the Reagan era. You know, during this time, there was almost bipartisan U.S. support for the dictatorship. Professor Cowan, can you tell us what role did the U.S. religious right play in molding the support, especially during the Reagan era?
Yeah, I mean, I think the religious right in the United States, much like the religious right in Brazil, really does a great job of aligning itself with the sort of most fundamental kinds of anti-communism in this period, right? And I say that because it's important to understand that both in Brazil and in the United States, anti-communism and religious moralism are very closely linked. I think we like to think of sort of episodes in the United States, like the House Committee Investigating Un-American Activities, and think about like maybe people who were carrying cards for the Communist Party. But actually, anti-communism in both countries was very much about people's personal moral behavior. So, you know, communists were identified maybe more by wearing a miniskirt or having premarital sex than they were necessarily by political beliefs. And so the religious right, both in Brazil and the United States, aligns itself with anti-communist authoritarianism as both a sort of a religious and a cultural and a political plank of this kind of anti-communism that is so powerful in that period. and that empowers the religious right culturally, politically, and socially, both in the United States and also in Brazil. And thus you get a sort of very friendly relationship between the sort of, you know, the Billy Grahams of United States evangelicalism and the Brazilian regime itself.
I remember growing up and becoming a young minister in a right-wing evangelical Christian environment. And at the time, the Red Scare was a big deal, you know, communism. And and fears like that, I think, tend to make your brain become very simplistic. You look for these simple things to grab onto. And I think you're right. The way people dress, who they have sex with, they're more. We Christians thought we were the really good people, and everybody else out there are these threats to us. So that's happening in Brazil as much as it is in the U.S. as well, you're saying.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, I think we can argue that it's still happening, right? Part of the answer to how we got here is that although, you know, the specter of communism has in many ways disappeared as a sort of a real phenomenon in the world, the religious right in the decades we're talking about successfully repackaged communism to mean something entirely different, right? And they did so in many ways in order to make the fear of change much more about people's ways of life and day-to-day customs than it was about actual policies. And hence we get a right today in Brazil, as in the United States, that's much more focused on issues of culture, sexuality, morality and behavior than it is on actual policies. The policies are incredibly unpopular, right? But it's very popular to talk about, say, the rights of trans children in school or whether or not people should be educated about homophobia in Brazil.
I was in Brazil a few years ago, 5 or 8 years ago, mostly up in the northeast, the Sertão area, which I think is a beautiful part of the country. And as I was driving around with my friends, I noticed almost every other car had a sign on the back window that said, "Este carro é propriedade de Jesus." This car belongs to Jesus, or vans or buses or things, you know. And there was just this...
You better be careful that Jesus doesn't send the repo man after you.
Or I suppose that sign is on the back of the wrecked cars as well. But this sort of evangelicalism or even Pentecostalism is kind of surprising in a country that was so Catholic. In your book, you tell the story about Bolsonaro. He's, you know, homophobic, where he said, what did he say? Anybody, you're welcome to come to Brazil to have sex with our women, he said, but not to have gay sex. What was that quote he said?
He was, you know, talking, deriding and opposing this sort of idea of gay tourism in Brazil. And he said something like, anyone who wants to come to Brazil and have sex with a woman, you're very welcome. But gay tourism, absolutely not, because I think the quote is, a gente tem família, we have families.
Yeah, we have family values. Wasn't one of the current presidents an atheist? Rousseff wasn't? Originally?
Yeah, I mean, part of what I'm trying to chart in the book is the ways in which it has become impossible, right, to steer clear of the power of the evangelical right, as much in Brazil as in the United States, right? What political scientists like to call the Overton window, meaning the sort of the window of permissible political speech, has shifted in both countries because religious right activists made it impossible to be the president of Brazil and call oneself an atheist. So we get a former Marxist guerrilla, right, who's become the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, who finds herself sort of obliged to recant on issues like abortion and to say things like, you know, to quote the Bible when talking about her position as the president of Brazil. And that is because the religious right has empowered itself so successfully in both countries.
So what is this, you mentioned Brazil's legislative... Bible, Bullets, and Beef Caucus. What is that?
Yeah, often called BBB, right?
That's BBB.
Bibles, Bullets, and Beef. Yeah. And, you know, I think if that resonates with people listening to this in the United States, it's because of the similar processes that led people to associate beef, the rural interest, with the Bible, religious interest, and also bullets, or national security, interests. And so, you know, in the United States, we can see that in the fact that, you know, if you drive through the countryside, you'll see signs for All Lives Matter, as well as for a lot of kinds of politicized religiosity. And it's the sort of the confluence of these things, right? The packaging of all of these as identities that I think explains how we got to the place we are, right? In many ways, it doesn't make sense to put these things together, but that's precisely what religious activists in the 1960s and 70s and 80s did, was cobble together an agenda that united economic conservatives with religious conservatives, with national security conservatives, right, in a way that was not only politically powerful, but then became a sort of the water that we swim in, right? It became the kinds of political identities that would lead people to vote for Republican candidates, for example, whose platforms make no sense in terms of coherence, but that appeal to these kind of fundamental presumptions in our political discourse.
Benjamin Cowan is a professor at University of California, San Diego. His new book is called Moral Majorities Across the Americas, Brazil, the United States, and the Creation of the Religious Right. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Cowan.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Amit, for being a co-host today.
Certainly, always a pleasure to be here in the FFRF studio.
And we want to thank listeners in Philadelphia to WOOM, listeners here in Madison, Wisconsin to WIDE, WMUU, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, KEOS in College Station, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KEPW in Eugene, Oregon, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, Black Sheep Radio in Bellows Falls, Vermont. It's called WOOL, Black Sheep Radio. WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And, of course, all you thousands of podcast listeners, please give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends and relatives to learn more about our show at ffrf.org/radio. And you can call us or you can ask for more information or request a sample issue of our newspaper, Free Thought Today, at ffrf.org, or just call 1-800-335-4021. So tune in next week for more Free Thought Radio, for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope